And being lost has turned into a metaphor for emotions in urban life, but actually getting lost still happens a great deal and twice as much this weekend, and we're hearing about it on the news. Search and rescue in New Zealand, we take it for granted as an incredible service performed by splendid, skilled and often brave volunteers. More than 90% of our search and rescue people volunteer. But they can't perform miracles. People die before SAR services are notified. They die in spite of best efforts to find and save them. There were 94 fatalities in the 2022-23 year from the 3,500 calls for help that went out. And you don't need me to tell you that people get lost easily in our bush. Terrain can be steep, rivers swift, weather can change, injuries and hypothermia are common. Experience doesn't always help our trampers and sailors. Mishaps happen. But tech is improving thanks to data aggregation. We now know what people tend to do when they get lost on land and what you will do if, heaven forbid, you ever find yourself without company, without your bearings, and without a clue as to what to do next. For much of this information, developing information, the world can thank one man. Dr. Robert Kester, who is now the CEO of DBS Productions, which carries out search and rescue research. Robert has a good connection with New Zealand, and he wrote the book Lost Person Behaviour, A Search and Rescue Guide on Where to Look for Land, Air and Water. And the second edition of that is about to come out. He developed software called Find, and he's been the developer of the International Search and Rescue Incident Database as well. Robert trained as a biologist specialising in neuroscience, and he's been on countless searches. Robert, thanks for coming on with us.
That's my pleasure.
Just some general stats to start, if you can oblige. When people are found on land, the great majority are found near what terrain features? I think we wonder about this and whether it follows a pattern when people get lost.
There are certainly patterns, but those patterns will largely depend upon what the person is doing and what the person is thinking. So hikers are going to behave differently than those with dementia, and certainly behave differently than those who are skiing. Most people, however, if you wanted to pick a single feature, are going to be close to what we call a linear feature. So that's a stream, that's a trail, that's a road, something you can kind of naturally follow or something that will naturally stop your progress.
And that applies to people who are both injured and uninjured, Robert?
So those who are injured are usually going to be fairly close to their intended route. Those people who are lost will often have greater distances from these linear features.
I'm assuming that applies to skiers because they can move faster too.
They can move faster. Skiers have a tendency, if they can find a structure when they're lost, they're going to break into it.
And I'll get to the people who have dementia as well, but 15 years ago, you were the person who began to crunch the numbers on this. Have the habits of the lost stayed much the same since you began this work?
Certainly, for those people with dementia, my first paper came out in 92. So that's many, many years ago. And in that very first paper, I had 24 cases. I now have thousands and thousands of cases. And it's remarkable how the distances and the patterns have remained the same. Where we're starting to see a difference is among the hiker population, that when they're lost, they're more likely to go uphill more recently, and that's in pursuit of a cell phone signal.
Right, that makes sense. Is it also, well, I guess it's a good strategy for that, if it works. Is it also a general...
If it works.
Yeah. With dementia, actually, there's a rule of thumb with finding people, almost literally a rule of thumb, as it were.
Yes, I was running searches and I happened to notice over time where I had done dozens of dementia searches that most of the subjects on the scale of maps we use are literally found that the distance of my thumb on the map. And while that worked really well for me, one night I got a very panicky call with somebody asking, Bob, I gotta know how long your thumb is. And I thought to myself, there's a better way of doing it than that. And that's when I launched my first formal study.
That's a good story. Seniors with dementia behave differently in the bush. We call the wilderness the bush in New Zealand. Those with dementia behave differently in that kind of terrain from other lost people.
Oh, most definitely. A real simple rule of thumb for somebody with dementia is they go until they get stuck. So if they're on a relatively straight trail or road, they may go a considerable distance. But if the road takes a sharp turn, or if there's, quote, a perfectly good road, they may walk straight across it. And then when the bush gets really thick and kind of grabs them, that is where they'll stay. That they usually won't turn around and back out as a somebody with typical neurological function would.
And that.
Hikers usually make mistakes at decision points. Think they're still on the trail, but keep going.
Yes, and I'm sure we all dread that ever happening to us, but it's very common. Maybe people, even experienced people, get lost. Yes, it's no absolute guarantee.
So there's a famous quote by the founder of the U.S. Boy Scouts where he asked the young scouts, "How many of you have been lost?" And like half the hands went up, and to the ones who didn't raise their hands or thought they had never been lost, he said, "Well, one of two things apply to you. You haven't spent enough time in the bush, or you're liars."
Minutes matter. I was reading about this. I mean, it can be like the golden hour for people with heart attacks in that sense. Minutes are really important in terms of finding them. We tend to think of people finding water and hopefully staying warm and hunkering down, but often it's not like that.
Time is critical. Time is not the friend of the missing person. Now, fortunately, you got a little bit more time with being lost. As long as you can maintain your body heat, it is probably the most important thing, because hypothermia can start to set in within 4 hours without the right shelter. Most of our subjects are going to last for at least 24 hours. Kind of an exception to that is lost runners who are often skimpily dressed. But after the first 24 hours, the chances of survivability can really start going down, depending upon a whole bunch of different factors.
Yeah, it does sound time critical. There are 41 different lost person categories. Wow. Depending on age and what else, please, Robert.
So 41, when I wrote the book, I'm now working on 75 different subject categories.
Okay.
It can range from, is there an external influence? So an example of that was anybody who falls into rushing water is going to drive the behavior. If you happen to be an abducted, the perpetrator will drive the behavior. The next layer down is, are you on some kind of wheel? So if you're on a mountain bike or a motorcycle, then we have people who fall into a cognitive class. So this is folks with dementia or autism, despondent or substance intoxication. Then below that, we have the age groups of children, where obviously a 3-year-old is going to behave differently than a 6-year-old. A tramper is going to be different than somebody who's trying to gather berries of some sort, and all the other various outdoor activities.
And for each one of them, each one of those categories, you do calculations based on your large amount of data, quite intricate calculations.
Yes, we not only look at the subject category, but we also look at the terrain. Are they in mountainous terrain or non-mountainous terrain? Are they in an urban environment or are they in the bush? And then finally, there's different models where we use the numbers, like how far are they likely to go? How far away from a trail are they likely to go? Are they likely to go uphill or downhill? What type of feature will we find them in? What is their survivability rate? Why do they get lost in the first place? And then we can combine all of these various spatial features and make predictions on where we should actually go and look for them.
And this almost goes without saying, but you've seen the results of that kind of close analysis over the years. You've seen it work and work and work.
Yes, I did one study using the technique versus not using the techniques, and fairly large study found it reduces the time of searches by 50%.
Gee, that's impressive. What happens, just to choose a couple of those categories, just broad ones, what happens typically with school-aged children when they get lost?
So sometimes they're hiking, sometimes they're just playing. It sort of depends upon the actual range of the school-aged children. They'd love to take shortcuts. That gets them into trouble. I often call it a long cut when you look at their quote shortcut. It's usually not the shortest distance between two points, but a lot of interesting points in between. They're willing to go off trail as part of their play. They do have the same spatial abilities as adults, but they're not refined, so it's easy for them to make mistakes. Their preferred pattern is to latch onto a linear feature and follow it.
Okay, which is very useful to know. What about, let's just do one other category. I know that there are too many to go through, but we have a lot of hunters in New Zealand. How do hunters tend to get lost, and what do they tend to do?
Well, when I first started collecting data, the most typical hunter scenario was they made a kill and they're following the blood trail to find the animal. And they're so intent on that, they're not paying attention to the landmarks and they get lost. So that was the traditional problem. A more recent sort of profile is they tend to be a little bit more elderly and they have a medical problem or they have a trauma problem of falling out of a tree stand or accidentally shooting their foot or falling off a cliff. And that's a newer trend I have noticed.
There are tried and true search and rescue strategies, and not to decry them because a lot of good people with a lot of skill have employed them. But you've just basically really upped the game in this area, haven't you?
Well, I just try to say I've done what evidence-based searching and analysis can do. Let's just see what works. And certainly one of the most important things to do is if you're searching where the subject isn't, you're not going to find them.
There's the Lost Person Behaviour app, which I had a look at on the App Store. A lot easier than carrying your book around all the time, I suppose, in the bush, Robert. So just to let people know, what does it tell you, the Lost Person Behaviour app?
Well, the app pretty much tells you the same thing the book does. It will tell you what types of questions you should be asking about the subject. It will give you a checklist of what I call reflex tasking. These are the initial types of tasks you should go out and do. It will give you a overall profile of the subject, what they're likely to do, why they get lost, how they behave. It will give you a tactical briefing if you're out there in the field. These are things you should be looking for. And then it will certainly supply you with all of the statistics.
And you're now working on software, I was reading, that takes weather, landscape, skill level into account when calculating how long people can survive, as you were talking about before.
I am. That is a work in project where you not only look at the subject category and the time that has taken place, but what are the weather conditions? Because that's obviously important. How prepared are they? What do they have with them? How much training that they have? What is their actual age? And it then predicts that their survivability curve based upon all those factors.
Dr. Robert Kester is with us. Do you also have to factor in, Well, I suppose you do. Depleting energy in people. Not only that they get thirsty and hungry, but maybe they'd simply run out of steam.
Run out of steam or run out of positive mental attitude.
Right.
And they just decide they're going to stay put or give up. Another statistic I didn't mention, but one I collect, is what's called mobility data. So a lot of people really don't stay in motion all that long. Now, of course, if you're going to read a story in a magazine about extreme survival, they'll talk about how the subject has moved for 4 or 5 days. But in most cases, people stop moving after the first 24 hours.
And that is actually a good strategy a lot of the time, or especially using your software and your calculations. That's the best thing to do, isn't it?
The primary recommendations SAR teams around the world make to lost subjects is, if you get lost, stay put.
Mm.
You'll conserve your energy. You won't do anything stupid. You won't make the situation worse. It'll give you time to make a shelter, hopefully make a fire, do all the things you need to survive without expending more energy. Now, the one caveat on that is, hopefully you've told somebody where you're going and when you hope to get out of the woods, because if no search gets started for you, that's going to be a problem too.
Yes, of course. Have you ever been lost?
Well, there's two parts to the definition of being lost. One definition is, you don't know where you are. And the second part of the definition is, you don't know how to get out of the situation. I have certainly experienced the first condition, where I did not know where the trail went, or the trail I was on, where it was going. However, I didn't have the full-blown emotional response that most people have when they get lost, because I knew how to get myself out of the situation.
In that situation, out of interest, what did you do?
I actually had a map and compass with me. So while I didn't know where the trail was, I had what is called a bailout direction. I knew that there was another trail on the ridge, and all I had to do was shoot a compass bearing to the top of the ridge, and on top of that ridge, I was going to find a trail. So kind of an hour out of my way, but it allowed me to find something certain.
I wonder if we're losing that map reading ability now in the age of GPS, and if that's a problem.
It can be. Map use is a perishable skill that needs to be practiced. I certainly always have a GPS with me, but you know, to keep my skills up, I'll try using my map and compass first. But then after I'm reasonably sure where I am on my paper map, I'll pull out my GPS and cheat and just kind of double check myself.
Your life work, as it is at the moment, has obviously saved countless lives. I mean, you're a lucky man in a sense. What better thing could you have done with your life to date? You know, you've made a big contribution.
I feel truly blessed on a daily basis. You know, starting off as a search and rescue person who would go out into the field in the middle of the night, in the middle of foul weather, to save somebody was satisfying in and of itself. But having the opportunity to teach others and help people around the world is beyond satisfying, and I can help save lives and stay in bed at the same time.
That's the ideal combination.
There'll be
cases, specific cases that you remember best, I guess.
There are, yes.
Anyone that jumps to mind in terms of satisfaction level that you were mentioning?
You know, most people tell tales of the big, long searches, and I certainly have examples of searches like that, but really one of my favorite searches was over with really fast. It was a search for a missing dementia subject. He had been missing for about 8 hours. The local fire and rescue resources, bless their hearts, without SAR training, had been looking for him for 6 hours. They requested the help of the SAR team. I arrived. the chief law enforcement officer walked up to me and said, "We're so glad you're here. We got 40 people who need to go out in the field, and I want them all out in the field in 10 minutes." I said, "Yes, sir." I looked at the map. He had been lost 3 times before. In every case, he had traveled north to sort of where his fields were. So I sent the first team to the first drainage or water feature to the north, the next team to the first water feature to the east, the next team to a interface between the fields and the bush that most likely had a barbed wire fence, but I couldn't tell for sure from the map. So I had a team check that perimeter. And the last team I actually sent across the street from his house to check the first drainage that would be across the street and through a field. And that team leader told me to my face, I was crazy. He's always gone to the north, and why would he cross a perfectly good road? And I just said, humor me. And 10 minutes later, he called back on the radio saying he had found the subject alive and well in that drainage that I had assigned him to. It
Why was he attracted to those drainage or water features?
wasn't so much being attracted. He went out his front door instead of his back door this time. Walked down his driveway, kept going straight, walked across the road, kept walking straight, hit the drainage or the water feature, and the briars and the bush was so thick it just sort of grabbed him and held him in place. So it's not so much an attraction to water as more of that's a stopping feature where the vegetation often gets thicker.
Gee, and there are dozens and dozens of variations on that theme depending on who's lost and what they'll do, and you've worked them out, which is a fantastic thing to do, as I said before. Before we go, you'll be acquainted with the quality of search and rescue in New Zealand, will you?
I have made several trips to New Zealand, and New Zealand should feel fortunate as to the quality of their volunteers and the energy put in by the police force. They truly are some of the best SAR resources to be found around the world.
That's very nice to hear. Thank you very much for your time talking to us today, Robert.
My pleasure.